We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
You know, Hub, I think you hit a great point there.
Hub Arkish.
The Arkish family in pro football media journalism has been around almost as long as the game itself.
670 The Score's NFL Insider.
I think the Packers have got problems on defense. I think they've got, you know, two great pass rushers. But other than that, it's not an impressive unit.
Shaw Media and Pro Football Weekly.
I have a lot of Packer friends up in Wisconsin, unfortunately. And they're all bragging, saying that this tight end that the Packers got is going to be a way better prospect than the ones that the Bears got, this guy that they got from Notre Dame.
So, Mike, you have to comment on the fact that your Packer friends know more about the draft than Ryan Pace? I mean, who cares? Yeah, but my buddy said so. Ryan Pace must be nuts.
Hub Arkish, isn't that getting better than this?
Hub Arkish with McNeil and Parkins on 670 The Score.
Hub joins us every Tuesday on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline to talk about football and all things to all people. Hub, how you doing, my friend?
I am good, Danny. How you doing?
I'm doing well. So the NFL is going to release its schedule this Thursday. And I have been told, in conjunction with that, just like in normal times, for the vast majority of NFL teams, tickets to games will go on sale Thursday night, as if there are going to be 80,000 people in football stadiums this fall. Is the NFL handling the schedule release the correct way?
Well, I don't have a problem with it. Is it the correct way? I don't know if any of us have answers at this point. Does it seem like the season will come off on schedule without any interruption? No, it really doesn't. But I'm not sure what else they can do. I think the selling of tickets and the taking of money is a concern. I am a Chicago Bears season ticket holder with seats that my dad got from his dad and that I inherited from him. And mine have been paid for since March, you know, because that's the way it works. And it's a lot of money that I kind of wish I had access to right now, but I understand. And, you know, the Cubs are going through issues right now in which they have just recently, within the last week or 10 days, announced the ability to get some refunds to their season ticket people, a choice that they gave them, but the opportunity, now that a full couple months have been missed. So I think the league is probably wise in proceeding business as usual right now. It certainly worked with free agency. It certainly worked with the draft. They are in place and ready to go if, in fact, things do come off on time. And if they don't, you know, then they'll just have to be careful PR-wise and how they treat their paying customers and, you know, how they handle either rescheduling or refunds.
With free agency and the draft, I have no problem with it. I had no problem with it because they can do it remotely and it doesn't involve a paying customer. And you could even argue that it helps their customers by way of entertainment and distraction. The NFL is Teflon. Like, they're not going to be hurt by any sort of PR gaffe here. And the burden of issuing refunds will fall to the Ticketmasters and the StubHubs and the ticket marketplaces of the world. So the NFL will probably be able to just wash their hands of any controversy that comes from it. But I don't get it. Like, why not just release the schedule and say, but we're going to delay individual tickets going on sale 45 days until we can figure out whether or not these stadiums are going to be filled. Like, I don't know why you need to sell tickets for a November football game in the middle of May. I don't understand.
Well, two, three things there in answer to what you just said, Danny. First of all, I do not agree that the NFL or the teams will be able to wash their hands of any issues or controversy if these games don't come off on time. I mean, Ticketmaster, whoever you're buying for, has policies, but they're dictated by their customers. And so if there is an issue with refunds, it's going to be the Bears who have to drive that, just like it's been the Cubs and the Hawks and the Bulls. And Ticketmaster isn't going to take the heat, number one. Number two, fans are going to enjoy this for a short period of time in the same way that they enjoyed, you know, I think the draft and free agency, and that you look at the schedule, you know, you analyze how it works out. Did they catch some breaks? Is there a tough spot? All that fun stuff, and we'll do shows about it. I understand we've already, you know, planned a special, you know, schedule release show, and so they will get the same bounce from it. Now, when you move to number three, is where it becomes a concern. And I don't disagree with you that you know, maybe it would have been wiser to wait and not create false expectations. But here's what my sources are telling me is going on behind the scenes. According to a couple different ownership groups, the league actually has three schedule plans, and they're only releasing one. The first one is a regular schedule, assuming that at least the season, if not, you know, OTAs, mini camps, and training camp starts on time. That's what you're going to get Thursday night. Plan B is a slightly adjusted schedule with the same games in the same order that would begin October 15th and run to possibly the first weekend in March. So you'd play the same 16 games in the same order. Part C, or plan three, is actually a shortened schedule if they do try and play a season, even though they're delayed well beyond where they're, you know, going to end up. So they're planning for all contingencies. I think what they're doing now is releasing the popular one. I don't agree or disagree. I wouldn't have a problem, as you say, if they waited, you know, a month or 45 days. But I don't see that they're going to be damaged in any way by what they're doing here.
Yeah, I just think it's fascinating because this one actually involves money from people right now who are a little pinched for it. And I don't see why it's necessary. Like, you could still sell out the games by selling those tickets July 1st if doctors say we can have people in the stands. Whereas right now, it seems overwhelmingly likely that if we have football games, there aren't going to be fans in the stands. So I don't really get why they're going to create that burden in the first place. Release the schedule and all of that. And in the grand scheme of things, obviously there are bigger deals here, but I think that this is like future headline. I could see us being in August. It's August. We're doing a show and it's official that there are no fans in stands. And we're getting a lot of people calling and texting the radio station saying that the refund policy is a complete cluster and they wanted that the money that they spent and they locked up in May, they're having trouble getting it back in August. So I feel like they're creating a problem for their paying customer that is very easily avoidable, given where I think we both agree where this is heading is football in some capacity without fans, right? You still think that we're most likely not having fans in the stands come football season.
Yeah, I don't believe there's any way that there's going to be 60,000, 65,000 people in Soldier Field the first or second weekend in September. I couldn't agree with you more on that. And secondly, again, I don't disagree with you, but you got to tell the whole story here, which is this isn't creating the problem. The thing that is very unusual about the NFL as it relates to the other major sports, and these are approximate numbers but very close numbers, 60,000 of the 65,000 seats at Bears games go to season ticket holders. Maybe it's 58,000, whatever. Sure. It is, but over 90%, well over 90%. And that money was already collected months ago, just like it has been every year. As I said, I got my notice in February. I made my payment in March. The deadline is, I want to say from memory, was the first weekend in April. And so that money was collected before we even got locked down and realized what the problems with large gatherings were, or at least we're fully grasping it. So I don't know that by adding, and I think it represents about 14,000 to 14,500 customers control those 60,000, roughly 60,000 season tickets. So now, with these 5,000, if the limit is four, you know, by adding another 1,000 people to it, I don't know that they're increasing the problem all that much more. They're going to have to deal with it regardless, and they're already stuck with that, whether they put more tickets on sale Thursday night or not.
We're talking to Hub Arkish here, McNeil and Parkins on The Score. So the schedule comes out Thursday, and you say that there are – you got sources that say there are 3 contingency plans for the schedule. After the schedule gets released, the next thing would be mini camp OTA type stuff. What do you think the next NFL event is after the schedule gets released?
Well, you know, at this point, I would even not even think much about OTAs. I mean, it's something that you can do, you know, with certain protections, but you can't do it with people 6 feet apart. You know, you can't do it in groups of 10 or less or 2 or less. So we've already heard from, Dr. Birx, who I think is theoretically running the show, that social distancing is going to continue through the end of the summer. So, I think the next thing that's going to happen is that we're going to hear the delays that are coming. I don't think there are going to be OTAs or mini camps this year. At some point, there has to be a training camp. You can't just put these guys on the football field. So I think the next couple announcements could be delays. And then eventually there will either be the beginning of a full or somewhat shortened training camp. But I wouldn't count on any, you know, OTAs or mini camps this season.
No, that's what I expected you to say. And it'll just be interesting to see how they handle it, because other than shutting down the facilities, which is big, I'm not saying it's not, they're the only league that hasn't had to deal with the reality of delays or an acknowledgement that they are really, truly affected by this. I don't know if you would say that that's fair or not, but like Major League Baseball, the NBA, the NHL, college sports, golf, NASCAR, UFC, they've all had to cancel stuff, delay stuff, outright say, we don't know if we're coming back. The NFL's public stance has been like, we're coming back and we hope to come back with fans. So I personally am interested in how they are going to handle the humility and the humbling nature of, yeah, the NFL is not bigger and badder than this disease.
Yeah, you know, Danny, you're absolutely right in everything you say, but it kind of comes under the heading of I'd rather be lucky than good, because it's not anything that they've done. It's just the timing of their season worked for them. And it's just one more indication, you know, the luck part of it, in addition to the knowledge part of it, that makes them so much bigger and so much more successful and so much more profitable than any of those other sports. And so when the time comes that they are going to have to deal with it, and I think most of us in this business agree that it's going to come. I don't know that it's about humility. It's not their fault. You know, I mean, I'm not mad at Major League Baseball or hockey or the Cubs or the Bulls or the Blackhawks. We're just disappointed, you know, but we're facing the reality. Now, the bigger issue that you know, I just want to stay away from, because I don't want to get into anything that smacks of politics or personal preference or anything like that. But the bigger issue is obviously what's going on right now in a day to day when we've had the highest number of deaths since the beginning of this, you know, pandemic reported in the state of Illinois, and cases still, you know, clearly at their, you know, new cases still clearly at their peak, that you have people suing to stop, you know, protecting us all. You have people now debating and getting upset. And again, I understand, you know, everybody has concerns and fears, and people need to work and support their families. But that's really going to be where this thing goes. We're going to reach a point where you can't keep the politics and the personal preference out of it, because you're going to get some percentage of fans, much in the way that they want to ignore common sense now and go back to life as usual, who are going to say that you're wrong in doing this. It, you know, all the stupid stuff, it's no much worse than the flu. All that stuff is going to come into play. And you know, at that point, the owners are going to have to do something they've always avoided before. So they're going to have to take a stand. You know, they avoided taking
exactly.
a stand. Yeah. When Donald Trump stepped in with his position, I'll call it, on you know, Colin Kaepernick and on public protest, the league didn't take a stand. You know, they said both we support our players, but we support patriotism, and they stayed silent. And Kaepernick has been quietly blackballed ever since. You can talk about all kinds of other issues. And most of us would probably prefer that they didn't take, you know, political stances and get involved in these conversations outside of the game. But in this case, all sports have been able to avoid it. And the time may or may, I hope it's not coming. I hope people aren't that stupid, that they really want to risk not only theirs, but other people's lives so they can be entertained. But, you know, the indications are that it's coming. And at that point, it's going to be not just the NFL, but all these sports are going to have to deal with it.
We have Dr. Rob Sitrenberg coming on in about 15 minutes, the infectious disease expert. This is going to be part of what we're talking about with him. We'll get to some more specific football things here with Hub as we have him for another 10 minutes or so on the McNeil and Parkins show. I started the show by talking about what Bears fans should be rooting for in terms of quarterback play. Like, obviously, you want the team to win as many games and go as far as possible, and you want quarterback play to be great. But what is the best-case scenario for the Bears? That Mitch Trubisky has a great quarterback season for them, or that Nick Foles has a great quarterback season for them?
Well, the best case is that at least one of them does, because in that case, they're probably a contender, you know, based on everything else that we see. As far as which would be preferable, I think it has to be that Mitch Trubisky becomes the quarterback that you drafted him to be, A, because you've expended extremely valuable assets to get him, and B, because he does have a higher ceiling and more traits than Nick Foles does. And so, you know, theoretically, if he arrives, that has to be the better option. But as long as one of them does, that's good enough. And I suppose if he fails, which is certainly a, you know, possibility, some believe a likely possibility, the fact that they got Foles and that he came through for him still leaves management and the coaching staff and the organization in a good spot.
Yeah, you and I agree here. Like, I don't think there's much chance of it happening, and I think they're prepared and going forward with Foles, even though they're saying it's open and Mitch gets the first reps. And it would be complicated. Like, if Mitch is great this year and you have to franchise tag him, and then you still have Nick Foles under contract, and you've got over $30 million against the cap next year tied up in Trubisky and Foles, like, there's going to be some uncomfortable cuts for the 2021 Bears, but Mitch is younger. Mitch has a higher ceiling. It would confirm Ryan Pace's scouting in him. So even if I think it's a 25-1 long shot or more that he has a great season, I think you've got to root for it to be Mitch over Foles if you're a Bears fan. Whereas, like, that's like the emotional side of it. The cognitive side is it's probably more likely to be Foles than Mitch if either of them is going to be great.
Yeah, it's best for everybody if it's Mitch. I don't know what the odds are that it happens. Again, at the end of 2018, I think the majority believed it would. At the end of 2019, the majority believes it won't. I can't predict the future. I know he has the ability. Whether he has the head for it remains to be seen. But I'm not terribly worried. You know, you see, when you point out the worst case, I'm not so sure it's all that bad. There are a number of NFL teams that already have in excess of $30 million tied up in cap space at the quarterback position. If Mitch, in fact, comes through and becomes the guy you want him to be, A, you've got a franchise quarterback, and B, it leaves Nick Foles with choices. You know, he can void the deal and leave, or now he can stay and be a quality backup, which, by the way, being the backup have always led to the best moments in his career. So we're 100% together on this. I don't know if either of them the answer. I don't know if Mitch can turn the corner, but if one of them is going to be, I think you have to prefer that it's Mitch, and ideally they're both ready to be great, and then the sport organization is set for the next few years.
Hub, if you had a Hall of Fame vote, would Frank Gore be on your ballot 5 years after retirement?
I believe that Frank Gore has to be a Hall of Famer. I do not believe he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. So hopefully I'm completely answering the question and not dying.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I want a guy in the Hall. To me, the first criteria I look at is, was he the best at his position for a significant portion of the decade that he was in his prime? And the answer to that is actually no, Frank Gore wasn't. But is he one of the most productive and greatest of all time at what he does? And no one can dispute that he is. So yes, I think he's a Hall of Famer. I don't see how he can be a first ballot Hall of Famer, but I'm expecting that, like a lot of these wideouts, you know, he'll wait 3, 4, or 5 years, or maybe only a couple years, and eventually get in.
You know, that's, you and I are in lockstep on that, because he is on the 2010 All-Decade team, which suggests sustained greatness for a long period of time, but he had one double-digit touchdown season, and it was 10 touchdowns. He's 21st on the all-time rushing touchdown list, despite being third in yards. He had one rushing yardage season over 1,250 yards. He never made first-team All-Pro, was only second once. Like, when you look at Frank Gore's body of work, the best thing that he did was he played in 14 games or more in 14 of his 15 seasons. Like, his availability and consistency was remarkable. 9 1,000-yard seasons, basically was never hurt, but he was never great. I don't have a comp for him in football. There's plenty of them in baseball, the compiler category. Mm-hmm. What comp do you have for Frank Gore in football?
Man, they're really hard to find, because you got to remember that he had ACLs torn in both knees in college. And he was a medical reject when he came to the NFL. And so to have survived and thrived, and you can't just talk about the 14 games or more without adding that 9 of those seasons were 1,000-yard seasons. Because while I don't agree that 1,000 yards is the magic mark for running backs anymore, it's one that we talk about, and the woods are full of guys who played 14 games in a season 4, 5, 6 times and never got close to 1,000 yards. So, The interesting comps, to me, if Terrell Davis is in the Hall of Fame, then Frank Gore probably should be a first ballot guy. And listen, I don't begrudge Terrell Davis. He's I'm going to say by all accounts, I know he's a high character guy. I'm happy for him. I have no regrets that he's in Canton, but he was not the best at his position for anywhere near a decade. He stacked 3 remarkable seasons, you know, and the fact that he won a couple Super Bowls got him in with one of the shortest careers and least productive careers of any running back in the Hall of Fame. As a matter of fact, the comp for him is Gale Sayers, who only played 7 seasons. Now, Sayers was the best running back in the league by far for the 3.5 seasons before he first tore that ACL at a time when he didn't come back from that. So I look at Frank Gore, and I just don't know how you deny him, but I think you do make him wait a couple years, because that's a fairly objective analysis of how the body of his work was put together.
Have you heard from any NFL people about Alex Smith and if he has any realistic chance of playing again? I'm not sure if you saw the documentary, but it was pretty incredible.
I wasn't aware of it, and I've been meaning to watch it ever since, because I've heard great things about it. By the way, what was it called again?
Project 11.
Yeah, I got to write that down, because I need to search it out and see it. Nobody really knows in terms of, and I've asked a lot of NFL people about it. I've asked Matt Nagy about it a couple times. People close to him have said if anybody can, it might be him. But they're waiting for medical evaluations, and he's nowhere near medically cleared right now. So, you know, whether or not he will get medically cleared, I guess a better way to answer your question is I've talked to a number of people who believe if he ever is medically cleared, that he will play and will be good again. But you know, short of doctors who are treating him, I don't think anybody knows if he's ever going to get medically cleared.
Yeah, I don't either. Obviously, we Bears fans went through it with Zach Miller and something very similar. You should watch the documentary. It was great. The access that he gave is for something so personal. There aren't many things that I've seen like it. It's very, very good.
I can tell you that I knew for a fact Zach Miller was, I shouldn't say for a fact, I knew with certainty that Zach Miller was never going to play again. And it's not like we're buddies or anything, but I know Zach. You know, I've done a few things with him, appearances and stuff. And all you had to do is take one look at him, and you knew he wasn't going to play football again. I haven't had access to Alex Smith, so can't even offer a visual opinion, if you will.
Hub, thank you very much, as always. Talk to you soon.
All right, Danny. Take care.
That's Hub Arkish, Pro Football Weekly, Shaw Media, right here, 670 The Score. We were actually basically in lockstep on Frank Gore. He used the not first ballot caveat that a lot of the Pro Football Hall of Famers do, and that's totally valid based on how they do it. And he's probably right. That is how it would end up, not how I would do it, but I'd say we agreed actually on about 90% of that. It's been a few weeks since we've talked to the infectious disease doctor, Dr. Rob Citrenberg. There are so many questions that I have now based on the Illinois plan to reopen, the protests that are happening, the mutations of COVID, the antibody testing, the false positives. I'm almost as confused as I've ever been. We will bring on an expert to hopefully clarify some things.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Next on The Score.
The McNeil and Parkin Show.
Guys, let me say, it's noble work you're doing.
On 670 The Score.
I'm highly confident that we're going to get NFL football, and I'm highly confident we're going to have the full 16-game season and the Super Bowl champion crowned in February in Tampa, Florida. Within there are some uncertainties. There are some things that we just need some more information about. What's happening with this virus? What's happening with testing? What's happening with how well when the players can come into camp? We have some gating issues, that we've never had before, where basically political leaders are in individual states and counties and cities are going to be able to make some determinations as to whether teams can play, can practice, go to their training facility, and then play games. And if they play games, how many people, if any, can be in the stands. So that's a new wrinkle here. More than a new wrinkle, it's a major issue. But as far as the games actually taking place, and those of us who enjoy watching on TV will be able to watch them and watch our favorite players play, yeah, I'm highly confident that that's going to happen.
The McNeil and Parkin Show on 670 The Score.
That's Mark Gannis. He was on with Mully and Haw today, sports business analyst for Sports Corp Limited. And this segment on The Score brought to you by Ameripro Roofing, standards through the roof. It's been a few weeks since we've had the director of infectious diseases at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital, Dr. Rob Citrenberg, on the show. And he's kind enough to join us on the Alpamonte Ford hotline. Alpamonte Ford is in Melrose Park. Dr. Citrenberg, as always, thank you very much for the time. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Danny. Thank you.
There are more important things than sports, but I guess we can start there. Do you agree with Mark Gannis's assessment of what sports will look like by the end of the year?
Honestly, no. I think it's wishful thinking. People want to be optimistic. That helps to make everyone happier to be optimistic. But if you look at the way the situation is right now, not only in Illinois, but around the country, I don't think we're anywhere near to having a situation where we can have sporting events with any regularity. Now, that may change maybe over the summer. We'll have better news with declining rates of infection, but as it stands right now, I just don't see it. We're just too far away from that.
What are the reason or reasons why we are so far away from that?
We're very early on in this epidemic, and it feels like it's been going on for years. It's really only been a couple of months since we've been immersed in it. But it's still early, and all the most realistic predictions say that this could easily go on for 2 years altogether. We're in the first wave right now. As the first wave begins to recede, might get a little bit better, but then we might be in for a second wave and even a third wave. This is what we saw, but what was seen with the great Spanish flu pandemic back 100 years ago, exactly that, different waves of infection. So even as the first wave gets better, we have to be prepared for a second wave. And that's especially concerning now that a lot of states are starting to open things up, that there's going to be a big surge in the number of infections that could essentially set everything, set the clock back to zero, essentially, which is would be devastating. So I just don't think we're at the point yet where we have any real confidence that the numbers are declining in any special way.
So you're a doctor, right? You're a scientist. You study infectious diseases. This is your area of expertise. When you see beaches and states and restaurants, not in Illinois, but in America, opening up, and you see protests in Illinois and all around the country, what is your medical opinion of what is happening in those situations?
It makes me uneasy. I think that people don't really understand how bad this disease is, and unless you are personally affected by it, by yourself, a family member, a friend, a colleague who's had it and maybe even died from it, unless you're personally affected by it, you may not see how bad it is. I still hear stories circulating that this is a hoax and it's the government's ploy to have control over citizens. And I'll tell you, I work in the hospital every single day, and it's real and it's still bad. So it makes me very uneasy that people are ignoring it, essentially, that they are going back to organized events, protests, et cetera. It makes me uneasy as a physician dealing with this every single day. It upsets me because, you know, we as a healthcare providers, we're going to the hospital every day, and some are, you know, actually risking our health and our lives to take care of all these sick people. And it bothers me that people just don't seem to get it.
So what do we do? Like, I got to be honest with you. It's not about me being cooped up in my house or, you know, economic restrictions. Like, we all want to do what is best here, or at least most of us do. But I have to be honest with you. Like, this is anecdotal, right? And I know that's not how scientists and doctors work, but I have a lot of friends who are young and healthy and taking it seriously, but they are saying, but my parents are going to come over, or I'll have dinner with one or two other people. And they're trying to, because they're like, it's risky to get in a car, so I have to have some willingness to have some level of risk. I cannot completely shut down my life in fear of this thing for whatever reason. Like, they don't want to stop their life completely. What do you say to the balance of an acceptable amount of risk that we take in everyday life as it relates to COVID-19?
Well, there has to be balance, because we obviously can't go on like this forever. We're going to have to get back into society and figure out the safest approach to do that. The first most important approach is that people who are the most vulnerable, who are particularly the elderly, those with a lot of chronic medical conditions, they do still need to stay isolated. You can argue that younger people and healthier people can start to very carefully and selectively reenter society, but not without risk. So I think if you isolate your highest risk groups, you can make some impact. But remember that even though young people often don't even get sick at all from this virus, they can still transmit it to others, particularly their parents or their grandparents. And that's the real concern. If you're a 20-year-old and you're healthy, you're probably not going to get really sick from the virus, but you can give it to somebody who can get very sick or die from it. So that's the dilemma. But we do have to figure out a way to get back into society. And I think the governor of Illinois today just released a 5-phase plan to reenter society, and we have to start looking at ways to do that. We clearly can't go on like this forever. But just so everybody knows, this is not without risk, even for those who are young and healthy.
Dr. Rob Citrenberg is the Director of Infectious Diseases at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital. The issue of testing, frankly, has been maddening and has seemed like a, and I'll politicize it, you don't have to, it has seemed like a colossal
federal failure. How many tests are we doing a day, and how many tests do we need to be doing a day where medically it feels safe to reopen society in a widespread way?
Well, as you mentioned, we got off to a really, really slow start with testing in this country. And I think back to even a month or 2 months ago when we couldn't get anybody tested. The right number of tests to do is, I'm not sure there's an actual number, but the concept is you have to be able to test anybody for any reason at any time. So anybody who comes away who's interested, might have symptoms, but an exposure to somebody who has the disease, you have to be able to test them. And until you have enough tests to be able to test everyone at risk, then you don't have enough tests. Now, we're getting a lot closer to our goal. It's much, much easier to get people tested now than it was even a few weeks ago, but we're still not at that point where every single person can get tested when we need them to. We need to go out proactively into communities, particularly the underserved communities where the burden of this disease is much higher, to be able to do mass testing and contact tracing. And we don't have the resources to do that yet. It is, so it's better, but we still have a ways to go. And to your point, I don't think we'll be able to get this epidemic under complete control until we are able to do complete testing and contact tracing of all those that are infected. And we're just not there yet.
Do you have an estimate on when we will be there?
The testing capacity has increased a lot. There's more companies that are producing tests, and the volume of the tests they're able to produce, the reagents, has gone up a lot. I would think within the next couple of months, we should have probably adequate amount of testing all over this country. But then the question is, what's the situation going to look like in a couple of months? How bad is it going to be? And that we don't know.
And you are anticipating, because anecdotally, it feels like it's getting better. Right, we're not seeing these cruise ships overrun with people. We're not hearing as many stories of hospitals being on the brink of overcrowding. People are not flowing into McCormick Place. Like it feels like it's getting better, but you anticipate it's going to get worse again?
Well, it is getting better, and the reason it's getting better is because of what we're doing. And this is a real study in human nature where people feel like they've been sitting around their homes for 2 months and nothing's happened. Nobody's gotten sick. Nobody's died. So they feel like they're wasting their time sitting home. But that is exactly the desired outcome. If you feel
right,
like you've accomplished nothing by sitting at home for 2 months, then you've done just the right thing. So the reason why things are getting better is that community transmission is down in Illinois. Right now, a lot of the new cases are from the nursing homes, but community transmission's down. Of course, you don't have any outbreaks on cruise ships because there aren't any cruises. We don't have any large gatherings, and that's why. So social distancing has worked, and it's worked really well. In fact, the models, and people are often critical of the models because the models are dynamic, but if we didn't have any social distancing at all, the numbers would probably be tenfold of what they are now in terms of number of infections and deaths, compared to what they are with social distancing. So it is better because of what we're doing. So the fear is if we let up on what we're doing, that we're just going to have a resurgence in the number of infections.
I've read a lot about these antibody testings, and there's so many different companies apparently doing them, and they're not all regulated, which seems odd to me, but way over my head. Why are so many of these antibody tests providing what doctors are saying are false positives?
These tests have been pushed through under what we call emergency use authorization. So they get released without being formally studied. Most of these lab tests, when they go through the usual FDA process, can take a couple of years to get approved. The tests have to be validated, but these tests are being pushed out under emergency use authorization. So basically anybody can make a test and say, hey, here, I have an antibody test, and they can start selling it. The problem is there's a huge variation in the quality of these tests. The tests that are done at some of our more professional certified labs are very good tests. Some of the other tests that are done maybe in some doctor's offices and some other labs are not good tests. The FDA has recently required submission of additional data from a lot of these companies to prove that their tests actually work. So what's the downside of that of the antibody testing is, first of all, even with a good test, we don't know what your antibodies mean. We know that it means you've been exposed to the virus. We don't know if it means you're immune to it, meaning that you can't get it again. That requires further studies. Just because you have antibodies doesn't necessarily mean you're protected. There are many viruses to which we develop antibodies that don't confer any long-term protection or immunity. So we don't want to view this antibody test as a golden ticket to get back into society. See, I have my antibodies. I can go resume my normal activities. I think that's premature and that's dangerous. And that's with the good tests. So the tests that aren't as precise, I don't think you can gain any meaningful information from that at all, and it might create a false sense of security if you think you have antibodies to the virus and you've never actually had it. So either way, I think it's really important to know what percentage of the population has had the disease, and that's what the antibody test tells us, but we don't have enough knowledge right now to know what to do with that information to say, are you protected or not? Now, down the line, when we can do further studies on immunity and on the antibodies, we might have a better answer and can say, yeah, if you've had this disease, you can go back into society and you won't get it again. We are just not there yet. So I really caution people about overreacting to the results of their antibody test.
Maybe this is unfair, and I apologize if it is. Is it fair to say that we just were not prepared for this as a whole?
Oh, I don't think that's an unfair question. We were most definitely not prepared for it. We, meaning our country and the world, was not prepared for this pandemic. And the pandemic has been either this pandemic or a pandemic like it has been predicted for many years and almost felt to be inevitable. But we have short memories. And the last great pandemic, we had the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Before that, it was the SARS pandemic or epidemic in 2002, 2003, and people were concerned about that when it was happening, but we have short memories and we forgot about it. And some of the pandemic preparers or planners have been preaching this for years and it's fallen on deaf ears. And so, no, we weren't prepared in any way, shape, or form. We weren't prepared with testing. We weren't prepared with personal protective equipment. We weren't ready. And we mean everyone, not just this country, everyone throughout the world. I don't think anybody was prepared for it. The only hope is that for the next pandemic, and there will be another one, that we will be better prepared, that we won't forget the lesson from this one.
Did you read the story in the Wall Street Journal today? Was Florida smart or lucky?
I didn't read it, but I heard about it. And we don't know the answer to that. You know, what's really interesting is that we don't know why some areas are particularly hard hit and other areas aren't. For example, there was an article in the New York Times the other day about how some countries that are right next to each other, one country is particularly hard hit and the other country has no disease. For example, I think the Dominican Republic has a lot of cases of COVID, and Haiti, which is right next door, has basically none. And Iran had a ton of cases, and Iraq has basically none. And we don't know why that is. So maybe there's some genetic factors and some other factors. So I'd be very careful about drawing conclusions about cause and effect, about what's happened, for example, in Florida. Did they do the right thing or not? It doesn't feel like they did the right thing right now. They seem to be getting away with it. But again, with this potential second wave, I think it's way too early to write the final chapter on this story. So we'll have to see what happens there and in other places where the restrictions are being relaxed.
Yeah. So like what, you know, 10 years from now, right? Someone writes the definitive book or study on this thing. What percent of the things that you as a doctor and people as scientists who study this thing, like what percent of, maybe I don't know the best way to ask this question, but like what percent do we know about COVID-19? Do we know 30% about it, 70% about it? I guess I just wonder how many more questions there are than answers right now.
Believe it or not, even though we've been studying this now day and night for the last 3 months or so, we still know very little about it. And we started zero. So back in January and February, zero, we still know very, very little about it, particularly how it's spread, why some people get real sick, why other people don't, how it's spread without symptoms, how far it travels. I would the best estimate I would have is we know probably about 10% of about this disease of what we need to know to manage it. So it's really, it's in its infancy. We know worlds more than we did a couple of months ago, but there's so much we don't know. You know, you look, you walk down the halls of the hospital, you'll see some people who have this disease who are just sitting there relaxing, eating breakfast, and the next person's on a ventilator, and they have the exact same risk factors, and we just don't know why some of them get really sick and some of them don't. So there are so many unknowns about how this disease progresses. There's unknowns about how to treat it. There's unknowns about immunity, unknowns about vaccination. So we're still in the infancy of understanding it.
That is a scary thought. Mother's Day is Sunday. If people want to get together in the backyard and say, hey, I have no symptoms, my parents have no symptoms, we're going to hang out in the yard, we're going to wear masks, that's safe? What can people do if they want to have small family gatherings?
You have to be very careful. I would not rely on the absence of symptoms. Certainly, if you had symptoms, you're not going to want to be anywhere near there. But we know this disease can be transmitted in people without symptoms and probably fairly easily. So someone, just the absence of symptoms doesn't make it safe to go out. I think if you're dealing with your elderly parents, my mom, for example, is 87, and I wouldn't go anywhere near her. I work in the hospital every day. I wouldn't go anywhere near her on Mother's Day because it's just, I feel like it's too risky. So, but if you are in a situation where you feel like you must do that, you have to use extreme caution. I would not really get within 6 feet of anyone. I think if everyone's wearing a mask, that's reasonable protection, but just to be careful. It's really risky at this point.
And then last thing, let me just pull it up so that I have it accurately here, given that you are the expert and I am not. Story today, a mutant coronavirus has emerged, even more contagious than the original study says. Is that proven? Like, are we already dealing with mutations of this thing? And where are we with COVID-19 or whatever the next thing is going to be?
Well, every virus mutates all the time. And so there are going to be strains of this virus that differ from prior strains just as they spread in different areas. They mutate, they pick up some different characteristics. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's a different disease. We have a lot of experience with influenza. There can be some minor changes, minor mutations that don't mean much, or major mutations that result in whole new strains and whole new epidemics. Right now, the current knowledge base, we still think there's just one COVID. There's just one SARS-CoV-2, which is the name of the virus that causes it, and that may have some minor mutations, but that right now we still think it's just one disease. Now, the way we'll find out about that is how easy it is to make a vaccine. So if there are multiple different strains and mutations of this virus, it's going to make it much more difficult to make a vaccine. So if we're able to make a vaccine against it, that will tell us pretty much that there's really only one important strain, one major strain, maybe with some mutations. It's too early to say if there are going to be mutant strains that are going to be impossible to vaccinate against. But so mutations among viruses are common. They happen all the time. I probably wouldn't overreact to that news right now. I would just still focus on the current state of the disease.
Dr. Rob Sitrenberg, the Director of Infectious Disease at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital. Always appreciate the time and the candor, even if the news isn't exactly what we'd like to hear. Doctor, thank you for the time.
My pleasure, Danny.
That's Dr. Sitrenberg. Says, in the scientific community, we maybe know 10% of what we need to know about this virus. Talking about more waves coming. Disagreeing with the idea of sports anytime soon. And people's calling him Dr. Fearmonger on the text line. He is a scientist. He is a doctor of infectious diseases. That is an expert. We appreciate his time and his insight, even, like I said, if we don't like what he has to say. We always like what this guy has to say, though. Matt Spiegel, it's his game of baseball. Does he love baseball enough to be watching Korean baseball at 3 a.m? We find out together next on The Score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.